So we're going from, you know, so we introduced the gospel last time. If you want the short version of the gospel, I think it's really just Jesus is Lord. And now we're thinking about sin and following, you know, those kind of the next two chapters really in Paul's letter. And this isn't everything one could say about sin. You know, I read one thing that suggested Romans is like a sort of a systematic theology, but I don't think that's really right. It's a letter that Paul wrote to some people in Rome with some particular concerns. But he does spend quite a lot of time in this next couple of chapters, and this is what we'll follow through. First, he argues that everyone should know, you know, should be able to recognize that God exists, but that even so, they haven't worshipped God or acknowledged God. And remember, the Roman churches are mainly Gentile churches at this point. Quite a lot of stuff in here is about Gentiles and Jews. So he starts off arguing, even if you're a Gentile, you should know. Talks a bit about the consequences of sin. Quite a bit about not judging others, and we'll spend a while thinking about that. And a little bit about the nature of God's judgment. And then, like I say, you know, he keeps coming back through this letter to what about the Jews? And so we get some more of that. Matt suggested that you should read through the whole book. If you have, then you'll have found some of the verses in this section, specifically about sexual sin. So we'll have a little look at that, even though the sort of Bible Society brief says, oh, that's a bit tricky to do in one service. So we'll, anyway, see what happens. And then we reach that final conclusion, our key verse for the day, about everyone who's fallen short, and will. So really we're thinking about what does that mean, and you know, so what is sin, what have we fallen short of? And I don't speak any Hebrew whatsoever, not particularly surprising, but those jolly nice people at the Bible Project assure me that this is what it means, that the word, at least the Old Testament one, kata, which means literally to fail or to miss the goal or fall short of the mark. So we'll think about in what way are we failing, and which mark are we falling short of. So, first bit of Paul's argument, everyone, the non-Jews included, have the evidence they need to know that God exists. What might be known about God is plain to them, the non-Jews and everyone, because God had made it plain, because since the creation of the world, his invisible qualities, eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, understood from what's been made. So people are without excuse that, you know, that there is no God. And I guess for quite a lot of us, you know, we do encounter God, or, you know, the sense of transcendence, you know, for example, in creation, in the countryside, or even in other people as we encounter them. So that's really Paul's jumping off point. You know, there are enough signs, enough of God's fingerprints in the world that really everyone should have some sense that God, the creator God, is real and involved and active. But, he says, although they knew God in principle, you know, they had that evidence, they didn't glorify him as God or give thanks to him. And really, as we'll see, that's kind of the heart of sin. Not glorifying God, and in practice not even giving thanks to him. So they claim to be wise, you know, they're so sophisticated, they understand everything that's going on, but they don't acknowledge God, and instead they exchange the glory of God for images, literally idols or metaphorical idols as well. So, often, I suppose, when we think about sin, we think of it as a matter of laws, rules, you know, as our little exercise at the beginning of the service. But I think at the heart of what Paul's saying is that it's not about rules, they're not the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter is a relationship. It's about people's relating to God. The problem, the first problem, the root problem, is that they haven't recognized God or acknowledged him or thanked him. You know, they've lost that relating. And perhaps not too surprisingly, you could say that Jesus takes a similar approach to kind of understanding what law might be. You know, so he's quizzed about the commandments, and I'm sure you know, he says, love the Lord your God with all your heart, all your soul, and with all your mind. That's the first and the greatest commandment. And the second like it, love your neighbor as yourself. Everything else hangs on them. So, I mean, there are rules. Rules try and regulate behavior. You know, they live in that kind of legal mindset. But what I think both Paul and Jesus are arguing is that the starting point for all of it is who or what is God to you? You know, we need a reference point before we can work out the rules that might apply. And I think also sitting somewhere in the middle are our thoughts and our feelings and our values and our principles. You know, so there are all sorts of rules that exist that appear to have no reason whatsoever. And or on the other hand, values and principles that are hard to articulate in rules, but which matter nonetheless. So as in those commandments that Jesus gives, most important one, love God. And second, love your neighbour. It's hard to enact that as a piece of legislation, isn't it? It's a value, a principle, a thing you try and live out in all kinds of ways. Now, of course, all of these things influence each other. I mean, you'd hope they would sort of flow from the top down, and they do to some extent. But as we'll talk a bit more in a moment, they also go from the bottom up. And what we actually do shapes how we feel about things and what we're prepared to take as our reference point too. Now, this is not a perfect analogy, but I was trying to think of other illustrations or analogies, and at that sort of rule level, maybe it's a little bit like signposts and directions. You come across a sign, it says no barbecues. In itself, it doesn't tell you a lot, but there may be a good reason for it, there may not. You know, you see a sign that says don't walk on the grass, is that just because you'll obstruct the view of someone who considers themselves very important, or is it because there are landmines? You know, it's quite hard to know just from signs and rules. At the top of the picture, our reference point is maybe a bit more like a compass. And certainly this is an analogy that's been offered to me before. And one of the interesting things about a compass is it's not actually ever so easy to use. You have to hold it carefully and you wait for it to settle and you kind of wave it around. But eventually it settles and you get a reference point. And maybe, although this is perhaps the weakest bit of the analogy, maybe the values and principles are a bit like having a map. You know, if you don't have a compass, you may end up with the map the wrong way up, and you get to the signs and you don't know what they mean, and it's hard to interpret. So to rehearse, Paul's saying the most important thing is this reference, God, this anchor point, like our compass that sets the whole direction for our lives. And then from that, things may follow in terms of values and principles and ultimately specific rules and behaviours. Paul then goes on to say that sin, idolatry, not following God or recognizing God, has direct consequences. And a lot of the consequences of our actions are that God allows us to experience the consequences of our actions. Sometimes you get these philosophical debates, if God is so powerful, why doesn't he ... Well, it seems that unlike most people with power, God does not use his power to control. So most of us, if we have a lot of power, we try to control things around us to make them work for us. But God for the most part, doesn't seem to. You know, he allows us to make our choices. You know, we choose to go in this direction, then like the prodigal son, you know, off we go. And the father waits, and the father waits, and the father never stops waiting. But the son, you know, still goes, and he squanders his wealth, and he ends up with the consequences of his choices. And I think that's what it's saying, you know, what Paul is saying when he talks about God giving them over to their choices. It's not that God says, oh, that's naughty, slap. But, you know, he says, it'll work better if you go this way. But they go that way. Okay, I wouldn't recommend it. But, you know, a lot of what then follows is that cascade of, you know, if it's not God that's my reference, if it's me, my pleasures, my desires, whatever, then it trickles down in all of my values and attitudes and the things that I do. And he has this really long, Paul has this big long list of, you know, all kinds of bad things. It always slightly amuses me that disobeying your parents is in here as well. You know, so you find that sign that says no barbecues, and, you know, sometimes, you know, it may not really matter, but other times, there's a very good reason. You know, it's going to start a forest fire, things have been dry. You know, there are very good reasons for rules sometimes. And like I say, God often seems to then allow us to live in, to some extent, a world of our, at least of our collective choosing. It's clearly not just a matter of what I choose. What I choose has a whole load of implications for other people. Paul spends quite a lot of time telling the Roman church not to judge each other. And his basic argument is you shouldn't judge other people because really you're no better. You can feel we're kind of working up to that final verse. You know, so you have no excuse. You pass judgment on someone else. At whatever point you judge another, you're condemning yourself because you do the same things. Oh, it may not literally be precisely the same things, although quite often it is. So you might ask yourself, why do we love judging so much? Why do we do so much of it? But then if you know, you only need to think for a moment, it's actually the first sin. You know? So in the Garden of Eden, you know, that sort of understanding of, you know, take it literally or metaphorically, doesn't really matter. But the first temptation to Adam and Eve is knowledge, to judge, to decide what's right and wrong for yourself, rather than depending on God to judge. You'll be like God. You'll be able to decide, to know what's good and evil. And we've been doing that ever since. So one reason why we do it so much and why the way in which we do it, you know, kind of gets rather convoluted is because we're all a bit like icebergs and actors. And I'll describe what I mean. So we're like icebergs in the sense that so much of what happens, you know, that we're consciously aware of, you know, that's like the sort of the above the water bit of the iceberg, is only a fraction of what's really going on in our lives, in who we are, in our behaviours and our actions. And there's a whole load of stuff, you know, which a psychologist might call the unconscious, and a whole bunch of our behaviours where we spend a lot of our lives just running on automatic pilot. Things happen, we respond. Things happen, we respond. Not only that, but there are all sorts of things about ourselves that we don't really like, and quite often we push those out of sight so that we don't have to, you know, kind of stare our flaws in the face all the time. So that's why we're a bit like icebergs. You know, we're only aware of a little bit of really what's going on in ourselves. And then we're also, with the best will in the world, always performing. And, some of it's entirely helpful and constructive, you know, so I'm talking in a certain way because it will help you to follow what I'm saying and understand what I'm doing, and I talk in a particular way when I talk to members of my family, a different way to students. But a bunch of it also that's really just unconscious, you know, so some of that performing is helpful, some of it's necessary, but some of it really is just about making us look good to other people. and whether that's consciously or unconsciously. Because we're together with all this stuff about ourselves that we're reluctant to see, means that it's all too easy for us, especially people who like rules, to end up in a place where they're playing the role of the person who follows the rules, unaware or forcing themselves to be unaware of the ways that they're actually themselves missing the mark. So we tend to play this game, you know, why do we judge? I think honestly, one of the main reasons is just to feel good about ourselves by comparing ourselves with other people. So we say, well, this is me, that's you. I want to feel good about myself by feeling that I'm better than you. So let's pick something that I can use to compare myself with you. And so obviously, because I want to feel better about it, it'd be good if I pick something bad that you do or something good that I do that you don't. And then I'll come up with some reason, conscious or unconscious, why that's really important. And that way, you know, I can go, oh yes, yeah, but I don't do that, so I must be okay. And, you know, throw in this whole sort of acting and not being entirely conscious, honest with others, or indeed with ourselves, and it's perhaps no great surprise that people can go through the whole of their lives, and you're kind of finding particular comparison games to play with other people to make themselves feel good about themselves without even ever really looking at the rest of themselves or the rest of someone else. So Paul really just says, don't do it. Really, just don't do it. You know, there is no way that you're going to win the judgment game at the end of the day. Leave the good judgment to God. So this is one of the, I think, the hardest ideas in here. You know, Paul talks about the wrath, the anger of God revealed against heaven, against all the godlessness and wickedness of people. But then he says, not, therefore God gave them a good whacking. But he said, you know, as we've just been talking, a lot of what God did was allow them to live with their choices. But being a good Jew, Paul also has this view of God's coming judgment, you know, of a kind of a line in the sand in time and creation when God will judge all things, after which things will be renewed, made new. And I guess, you know, you think about that language of wrath and of judgment, and some of us will have grown up in traditions that, you know, kind of made a lot of that, you know, used it as a way of beating people up over the head. And you end up with a picture of God that's much more like, you know, Zeus, one of these kind of Greek gods with immense power and the emotional development of a two-year-old. Whereas we know that Jesus is God, the image of God, he reveals God. And you think, well, what? That really doesn't seem to fit with the God that I see in Jesus. You know, so maybe some of that language is really leading us in a very unhelpful direction. I mean, parents do get angry. You know, your kid runs into the road, you grab them out and you tell them you really shouldn't do that again. But it's not. It's not punishment in the way that we often, you know, sort of envisage it or imagine it here if we think of those sorts of words. We can't really bottom this out in the time available, but here's another way of looking at judgment. You know, so if you're feeling ill, you go to a doctor, they find out a bunch of stuff, and at some point they make a diagnosis, they make a decision. Okay, here's what I think is wrong, and here's what we need to do about it. So I think there is also a sense in which we can see God's judgment in the same way. You know, there comes a point at which God draws that line in the sand in creation, and he assesses what's been made and what's gone on, and the parts that's good, can be saved, renewed, the parts that are bad, some of it needs excising, some of it needs remaking. Not individual people, I think, but things that have happened, stuff that's gone on. So, next bit of Paul's argument, as I said, you know, remember in the Roman Church, over the previous 10 years, all the Jews have been thrown out of Rome for a while, and then the Jews have come back. So the church is mainly Gentiles, but there are some Jews, and in the early church, there's always a lot of confusion and discussion and debate about, you know, is it worth being a Jew? Is it okay to be a Gentile? How does it all work? And Paul comes back to that at various points, but here, the main point he makes is Gentiles had no excuse for not knowing about God apart from the law. On the other hand, the Jews, in a way, they have even less excuse. You call yourself a Jew, rely on the law, boast in God, you're no better off. And when he talks about the law, he doesn't just mean the rules. You know, you make a list of rules from the Old Testament. As Jesus said there, in his commandments that summarized the law and the prophets, he's really talking about the whole history of God's relationship with Israel, God's relationship with his people. That idea of being circumcised, being a member of the people. And because what the Jews were often tempted to play in their comparison game was the game of being one of God's chosen people. So I'm a Jew, I'm special to God, that's what matters. You're a stinky Gentile, so that's your problem. But Paul says, that's not the game that we're playing. What's actually in the scales here is the whole people of Israel's response to God and his call on them. And let's be honest, that's been one endless series of falling short of the mark. Right from Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, you name it, right through the whole Testament. God keeps calling his people to himself to be an example for the nations and a route to peace for the nations, and they keep messing it up and he keeps coming back. So Paul says, really, you don't want to play that game either. You're no more likely to fully satisfy God's calling on Israel now than our ancestors were. So, like I said, if you read the whole passage, there's some just before the sort of laundry list of bad things that Gentiles might do if they don't acknowledge God, his sort of leading example is about sexual sins, and so you conjecture, he's thinking about talking to the church in Rome. What's one of the most obvious cultural challenges and problems with the Roman Empire and the state of society in Rome? So he picks sexual misconduct as an example to start with. And he talks about God giving them over to their sinful desires of their heart and sexual impurity for degrading their bodies with one another, and he picks up specifically homosexual acts. And you get some verses which have been used over the years to beat people over the head with. We don't have time to kind of do the whole debate around the Bible, God and sexuality. But I guess just a couple of things. One is sex and sexual conduct is a really judgy topic. It really plays very strongly into this whole sort of arena of finding things that I don't do or can pretend I don't do, that you do, that we can make nice comparisons and I can feel better about myself about. And sex and attraction are also, powerful and universal things. They're a significant part of being human. Often people feel a bit uncomfortable about them, and that makes the picture all a bit complicated as well. And quite a large proportion of the scandals, for example, involving Christian leaders, are something to do with sexual misconduct. You know, it's an area that has a lot of power to it, and a lot of potential to divide. Now, actually sort of slightly picking apart Paul's argument here, he says the problem is they've chosen, instead of taking God as a reference point, their own desires have become their reference point. And from that, the values that they've taken on are primarily lust, which is partly about sex, but perhaps more about control and possession. And they have rejected any values of purity, and that leads to certain forms of behaviour, which also, you know, the Old Testament has a number of rules about, it's pretty down on. Now, if you're, you know, kind of coming from a place of wrestling with questions like, for example, is gay marriage A, biblical, or B, you know, something that Christians should be comfortable with, should be accepting of, then you might question those verses in a range of ways. You know, what exactly do they mean? What exactly are they referring to? But one of the sort of structural ways that you might question it is to say, well, that may have been the situation, you know, for this sort of hypothetical sinful Romans that Paul was talking about there. But what about someone who is seriously trying to follow God and whose values are following from that? You know, they're what we might call fundamentally Christian values of, for example, faithfulness and purity. And what about those parts, even in the Old Testament scripture, that seem to talk very strongly about inclusion and not about, you know, rather than about division and labelling particular sexual acts as wrong? And, you know, so that's an example of the, you know, the kind of way that someone who, you know, is equally faithfully attempting to engage with God and Scripture, you know, might come to that question. From that, you might reasonably conclude, yeah, no, actually, within the whole thrust of God's relationship with all that He's made and the story that's emerging through Scripture, you know, I think we could get, you know, we could acknowledge and recognize gay marriage, for example. So we get to the punchline. Everyone has sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Now, in a way, you know, you kind of, there's a version of this, you know, which is a bit in that sort of worm theology tradition, you know, we're all terrible, we're bad, bad, bad. Who would ever think this was a comparison worth making? Who would ever compare people with God and expect people to stand up okay? You know, is there anything remotely surprising in everyone falling short of the glory of God? Well, no, not really. So, in a way, the strange thing is that Paul says it at all. And maybe part of what he's saying is, actually, we didn't have to fall short of the glory of God. You know, if you go back to Genesis, well, how were we created? We're created to image God and to, you know, to be God's agents in creation. You know, so maybe that creation ordinance is really saying, well, actually, you know, this was our calling, was to match up, to meet up to the glory of God. Now, we've fallen short of the mark, but that's actually what we're made for. That's where we're aiming. So what is God's creation purpose? That, to image God. And yes, we put ourselves in the scales and, you know, we come up wanting, but not because it's fundamentally impossible. You know, so spoiler alert, talk about salvation next week. So Jesus is the human being who is the perfect bearer of the image of God, who does live up to God's creation purpose for humanity. Not only that, but God in Jesus also allows us to kind of press the reset button, to make that fresh start, to daily, you know, come back to that aspiration, you know, to that vision and ambition, to actually try and measure up to that mark. So, four, you know, kind of conclusions, I suppose, or reflections on Paul's argument. If, as Paul says, God is, his reality is visible to everyone, then, and this is where, you know, some of the words on that sheet sort of expand on some of these things, and we'll reflect about them in a moment. If God is visible to everyone, how do you encounter God? And is there something maybe you can do this week to, you know, to kind of do more of that, to fill up on God a bit more? Paul argues our fundamental problem isn't breaking rules, it's idolatry. It's having the wrong priority, God in the wrong place. Whether it's us there or success or power or whatever it might be. Again, reflect less on keeping and breaking rules, more about on priorities and distractions. As I said, Paul's pretty down on us judging each other. Leave the judgment to God, he says. So it's worth considering whether we're doing that, either individually or as a church. It's a hard thing to tell, you know, because we often believe our own publicity. But worth attempting. And then finally, although it's in the other order on the sort of the detailed questions, yes, we have all fallen short. Not a shocker. But in a way, like I said, part of what I really took from that is the encouragement of just how extraordinary the calling that God has made on his people is. You know, the calling to image God in the world and to, you know, to begin that work of renewal and recreation. You know, so it's much, you know, what I hope we kind of take from it is it's much less about feeling bad and afraid, but it's much more about hope and aspiration, you know, that vision of God and the renewed humanity. So on your sheet, you've got, you know, these slightly more detailed prompts. And so what I suggest you do is kind of reflect quietly. We've gone hugely over time. Might have over-egged it a bit. But spend a couple of minutes reflecting on that, make any notes, try and think of one or two things you might do this week. Make a note, maybe tell the person next to you, this is something I want to do this week.